So tonight, this is a talk coming out of Buddhist Action Month. So across the world, in many different Buddhist organisations, Buddhist centres, particularly Triratna, we will be marking or trying to bring more consciousness to our relationship to the world. That we come along here and sit and meditate and talk about things, but actually at some point we need to enact or embody these teachings in the world. So this has been happening around the world, these different discussions and talks on this subject. So tonight I'm going to be trying to say something about revisioning our relationship to the world. And next week we'll be looking at we're going to be actually doing a puja, special puja, in relation to BAM. And then on the week after that, Shanti Garba, who's a non-violent communication teacher, has just published a book, so he'll be coming along to talk a bit about that and about non-violent communication. So that's going to be the sort of the month. So last week, just to remind you, we had Amravatra here, who gave a really beautiful evening for us. And one of the things I'd just like to comment on is that there was a request for Dana last week, and we, Amravatra, myself, the centre team, were so moved and affected by the kind of outflow of generosity from the Sangha. So thank you all for your gifts. It really supports. Well, last week we were talking, we're raising money specifically for supporting activities in Poland, and we've virtually met the target that Amravatra was asking to achieve. So that's amazing, just in one night. So that felt very productive, and also there's been some very generous contributions to the centre as well, so much appreciated. So there you are. I'm just going to start now. So, just to say, the sort of opening bit of this talk, I'm just going to use a bit of material from David Loy, who's a Buddhist scholar, Buddhist teacher, he used a couple of images that I'm just going to work with tonight to start with, which is two icebergs. So I'm going to... That's going to be the start for my talk, and then I'll say something more after that. This first iceberg that I'm going to talk about is called the ecological emergency iceberg. So we refer to it as an iceberg, really, because there's one bit which is very visible to us. So it's kind of... hopefully quite clear that there is something going on this planet. And what is really rather difficult about it is that it's a clearly a human-inflicted crisis that we find ourselves in. That this emergency... Well, we need to... there seems to be a real need to actually wake up fully to what's actually happening in the world. Because unless we do wake up, unfortunately, it seems that we will probably, as a species, be wiping ourselves out. So there's quite a kind of strong need to wake up. So... that's the kind of surface level of it, which I imagine we all know about. You don't have to kind of look very far to get this all this kind of information coming towards you about what is happening with the planet. We could sort of go on. I'm sure we've all got our little pet thing that we know about and really kind of get locked into. The main thing is that whatever, wherever we turn, we find that human beings are... causing absolute havoc on the ecosystem. So describing this as an iceberg, because that's the kind of the visible level of it. But what we probably don't see or is less kind of obvious is that what's the kind of causes or the some of the reasons for this crisis. And it seems that one of the problems is that we live in a more and more in a global environment where religion, the values that used to kind of glue societies together, have been lost, and all that's left is the religion of consumerism. Now, I'm not saying we're all here sitting here. That's the sort of only basis of our engagement with the world. But it's such a powerful influence in the society. So David Loy actually describes it as the institutionalization of greed, hatred, and delusion. So as you know, when we looked at the Wheel of Life, and I'm sure many of you know, this is the kind of core driving factor that is creating suffering for ourselves and for each other. Greed, hatred, and delusion. And now, these forces, through the religion of consumerism, are actually being driven, actually being used as a basis for interacting and kind of bringing us our values in our life. So greed, well, the whole notion of growth, capitalist growth, is based on generating, producing greed in us as a society. We have to keep consuming to keep the whole system afloat, which is desperately depressing. So, sorry, I won't depress you all the evening. But I think it's really important to mention it, you know. This is what's happening. We are, this society that we live in is primarily driven by these forces. And they're actually become integral to how the society is operating. So we're being encouraged to spend, seek the next hit, seek the next pleasure, get into debt, etc. We know the storylines for greed. And hatred, of course, well, we can see the way society is being polarised, the world is being polarised, into creating these kind of divisions between humanity. And it's great for trade. You know, if we, the more hatred, the more war we can generate, this really is very productive for keep stimulating economy. And it also makes the society much easier to control. Because if we're in a state of anxiety and stress, we tend to just kind of knuckle down and keep ourselves kind of out of the way. If we're feeling really positive and expansive, we'll actually start to open out, look into the world, look to each other, form much more positive connections with life. If we're in this force of anxiety, generated by this kind of splitting society, splitting countries, nations, it really impacts on our collective mental states. And then delusion is the other thing that happens, is that, well, as we know, more and more, the media is, they're not to investigate and kind of really get to the nub of truth, of what's really happening. It's there primarily to draw us in, to sell advertising, to promote certain values, to instigate hatred, instigate greed. And so news, truth, becomes very distorted simply for the... well, it's become institutionalised as a way to... well, to feed these other forces. Does this ring true, or am I kind of imagining this kind of scenario? It's kind of, yeah, I think it's worth Well, I'm just laying this out as a preliminary to try to say something a bit more constructive, but I think it's an important territory to really name it. And the second iceberg is the iceberg of Buddhism. So Buddhism is floating in this same world system, and well, we're wondering how to respond to this crisis that we find ourselves in. And so what happens is that on the surface, we see that some people get involved in sort of social engagement, eco-dharma, some of these kind of some activities. And some of us have got involved in sort of mindfulness. Mindfulness has become very popular in the culture. And so these kind of things seem to be the areas that Buddhism, on the whole, is where it becomes visible, where it becomes known in the society. What we're doing here is fairly niche. You know, this is, in terms of the whole of Bristol, this is a very small number of people who are interested in practicing and living the Dharma. But, and, you know, there is these things which tend to be more popular in society. So, we do have mindfulness training. Mindfulness seems to be, well, it's almost sort of going off now, but it's certainly quite a phase of being very popular. And what part of the kind of this lack of real engagement with this crisis is in part due to these things below the kind of visible layer, visible form of this iceberg, the Buddhist iceberg. So one of the things, or two things that we might just consider very briefly, is we have two things which kind of are fairly inherent in Buddhism. So the first one is what David Loy describes as cosmological dualism. So, fancy word. What it really means is that some of the ways, certainly in early Buddhism, that the path was described as a means of transcendence, of lifting out of the world, a means of nirvana is described as extinction, the end of becoming, and all these, and it's also described as Buddhism sees the world as a mirage, as a bubble, an illusory place. The world is illusory. This is kind of some of the ways that Buddhism is talks about the world that we inhabit. So because of this, well, the world's in this crisis, but, well, it's illusory. So what's the problem? It's mind-made. What's the problem? Etc. So it's quite a dangerous way of twisting Buddhist thought, Buddhist ideas. They do become distorted, but they're what can happen through these ideas is that our engagement with the actual world around us can become diminished, can become undervalued. So this is cosmological dualism. The other aspect of Buddhism, Buddhist thought, is that in some schools of Buddhism, there's the notion of individual salvation. So we've talked about mindfulness already briefly, and within mindfulness we have this notion of Buddhism as a path of personal development, that we can come here and the world is too grim and gruesome, so we can come here and meditate and just kind of allow all that anxiety and stress of being human in this current situation to dissipate, and we can forget the world through meditation. So this is I hope you realize this is a sort of characterization, or it's not, of course, it's not the whole of Buddhist practice, but I'm just using it as a way to kind of, I suppose, point towards these kind of underlying tendencies that maybe aren't particularly visible in our experience. The way we, you know, do we use meditation actually to kind of numb ourselves subtly? Do we use it? Do we really turn and face what's happening in the world? Or do we use it to take ourselves out of the stress and strain of being human at this point in history? So individual salvation can be seen that we practice for our own well-being rather than the well-being of the world. This is, you know, probably we all suffer from this to some extent, and it's perfectly natural. We want, you know, we, in a way, we need to be relatively well-resourced before we can really engage with life. But how much of that balance is something that may be worth kind of thinking about for our own practice. The other thing, well, I'll just put this in here briefly, that mindfulness tends to maintain a status quo. So, as you probably know, if you kind of get into samatha meditation, it's a calming, it's a stilling meditation. So we can take off some of the kind of peaks or troughs of our experience and become, you know, a bit more calm and mellow through mindfulness practices. But again, unless we're careful, that can carry us away from actually really fully engaging with the world. So, how are we doing with that so far? I'm kind of aware it's quite a difficult area to look at, but I feel it's kind of important to face this, particularly in Buddhist Action Month, when we really are trying to engage with the world. So this is really saying, is this how it is for us? Is this how our practice is for us? So I'm now going to turn to the kind of core of the talk, which is also the title of the talk, which is Revisioning Our Relationship to the World. So as you know, over the course of this year, we've been looking at the Triratna system of practice. And just going to go briefly through the system to have a look at how we might engage with the icebergs in a slightly more productive way. So, where to start? Let's start here with integration. So, for those of you who are new to Triratna's Dharma input, we talk about a system of practice which goes through five different modes that we're working with, either as a sort of a linear path or as a mandala of different practices which we are trying to gather together to create a very substantial and whole spiritual life. And the first element of the system of practice that we teach, that we promote, is the element of integration. So through our spiritual practice, we're trying to integrate all that we are. And I thought I'd just mention the image of the Wheel of Life, which I think all of you will have seen, even those of you who have just done the intro course, you will know that the Wheel of Life is this kind of circle which is said to be a mirror of the effects of being driven by greed, hatred and delusion. The whole Wheel of Life is a model, a teaching that is centred on greed, hatred and delusion as the sort of driving force of this wheel. And one of the ways that I find very fascinating about it is that it's pictured as sitting above a landscape, a world. So if you look at most of Wheel of Life images, paintings, photographs, you'll notice you've got the wheel, then you've got this big being grasping at it, and then behind or surrounding that, there is a landscape. So one of the things that greed, hatred and delusion does is that it creates a sense of selfhood, and it creates a sense of separation from the world. And what I'm trying to explore in this part of the talk is how can we revision our relationship to the world through this process of integration. So for me, one of the main things to start to look at is to acknowledge that we are interdependent with the whole world system, with the whole biosphere. We cannot separate ourselves out from the world. And the extent that we do that separation, we not only cause ourselves harm, but we also cause harm to, or there's a tendency more to create harm to the world. So the more that we can integrate this sense of being part of the world, being in the world, then the more likelihood there is that we will actually approach it, approach life, approach this world system in a much healthier way. So integration is this bringing together our own inner experience, our own inner life and the world. And the invitation through integration is to join in this dance, this dance between self and other, and to see that both are integral to each other. And one of the ways of looking at this is that that this dance, what it does, it starts to break down the sense of me and you, me and the world. If we really get hold of that, to see that this illusion of selfhood, this illusion of a separate being, the more we can kind of really get hold of that, we start to integrate our connection with the world. So this is really going into what we might describe as the Shunyata teachings, the teachings on emptiness. Just drop that in. And so not to say too much about that, apart from one of the key teachings, as you'll hear in the puja when you come to do it, is that there's this, we recite the Heart Sutra, and within that it talks about form is emptiness, emptiness only form. And what that's pointing to, as far as I can understand, is that we are completely and utterly interconnected, interdependent. So it's empty of any separate selfhood. And yet, there is something that is constantly arising. The world is here. We are of the world. We are in the world. So although it's constantly in a state of flow and movement, and there's nothing permanent or fixed within that whole flow, there is something arising out of emptiness. And this is what we're engaging with. So life is transitory because of that. It's sometimes painful. But also, within this dance of reality, this abundant outflowing of appearances, there's also joy, there's meaning, there's poetry, there's beauty, there's trees, plants, oceans, there's gutters, debris and cracked pavements. All these things are just emerging, arising in this field of our experience, and moving and flowing. And opening to that truth, the truth to integrate that, all those experiences as being part of us and we being part of them, is a very enriching experience. Integration feels wholesome. It feels delightful to feel complete in some way, not split off from life. So this is the first stage, joining the world. Second thing I'd like to just say a little bit about is really seeing that we are not separate. And when we really see that, when we really engage with life as it is, with curiosity, what actually tends to emerge out of that is love. When we really open to the world as it is and start to really see it and know it through our senses, well, that is a state of love. Because we know when we're in love, it doesn't matter what that person that we love does, it's delightful. All those little quirky habits that people have that we find so kind of entrancing and delightful. And it's the same with the world. When we fall in love with the world, it doesn't matter what arises in front of us, we approach it, we come into relationship with it with curiosity, with interest, with care. This is the development of positive emotion, to really engage and open to the world. So we serve the world through attending to it. So this is the sense of, that we are sensing beings. We meet the world through our senses. So just positive emotion as really opening the senses. So really hearing the sounds, smelling. There's these amazing flowers I'm trying. Thank you, Kath. Amazing smells coming to us. There's, the temperature. The temperature of the sun coming through the door there. All these things that we can kind of feel and know and love. So this is, the more we kind of really open, we fall in love. Well, the encouragement is to just fall in love with the world, whatever appears, whatever arises. And when we love, one of the things that, what comes after that is then through love, there's the desire to protect, to honour, even worship. This is all aspects of true love. And what's more is that we see below the appearances. We see into the living mystery of being alive, connected with our own precious life and the precious life around us. And this is what positive emotion is really encouraging us to do, is to connect with what's right in front of us. And this is our work as aware beings, is to connect, to feel. A little poem from Basho, who was an amazing poet wandering Japan in the 15th century. The temple bell stops, but the sound keeps coming out of the flowers. So that's positive emotion, that kind of sense of service through attending. So the more we open up to life, the more we connect to the world through positive emotion, the more mysterious and beautiful the world becomes. The minute creatures, the clear blue skies, distant mountains, There's this wonder. And through wondering and being kind of entranced by life, we actually, what we tend to do is then let go of control. And this letting go of control and release is, I kind of see it as being similar to going for refuge. So there's this movement towards really honouring that which is most sacred, most important, most valuable to us. We see that in the world and we start to move towards it. So this is this section in the puja where we go for refuge, and then out of that, as we try to connect to the world, and we do connect to the world through love, through attention, what then happens is that we go into a phase which is this spiritual death. Because what then happens is that we recognise or we relearn this presence of the world, but we also see more clearly the consequences of our loss of connection. We see the harm that we're causing or have caused through our loss of connection to the world. So spiritual death is really letting in the pain of what we individually and as humans have done to the planet. The shame and feeling into this territory. It's not as a sort of act of self-punishment, but actually to remember, recall, and really realign ourselves to our values. So this stage in spiritual life is said to be really crucial, certainly crucial within the puja. That movement from going for refuge to confession is seen to be a really key part of the puja. And it's key because it realigns, it revisions our relationship to the world. It's really important that we experience the consequences of our actions. This is said to be a spiritually positive, the spiritually positive aspect of shame is that we open to really know the consequences of what we've done. And this is what we're trying to do by opening to the world in this stage of spiritual death. So it's really necessary for our practice to feel the consequences of our actions or non-actions. And we maybe can feel the arrogance or the blindness underpinning our relationships to the world. But it's this knowing that really we just allow that to really enter into our being, to purify our vision, purify our relationship to the world. So just to finish this little section, just going to read quickly a little Precy of this is from the Sutra of Golden Light, really amazing text. This is a very condensed bit from the chapter on confession, strangely enough. So this is a reading from the Sutra of Golden Light. Then the Bodhisattva Rishikesh slept. In the middle of his sleep he saw a golden drum, which was made of gold, shining everywhere, just like the orb of the sun. And there he saw a person in the form of a Brahmin beating that drum. And from the sound of the drum he heard these and similar confessional verses coming forth. By the excellent drum of golden light, let the woes in the triple thousand worlds be suppressed. And by this resounding of the drum, the sound of the drum, may all troubles in the world be suppressed. May beings be without fear, free of fear, just as the great sages are without fear, fearless. May those beings who dwell in an evil state, their limbs alight with blazing fire, hear the sound of this drum. May they take up the refrain, homage to the Buddha. May all beings be mindful of their former births, during hundreds of births, thousands of millions of births, continually mindful of the great sages. Let them hear their word, for it is noble. And by this resounding of the noise of the drum, may they always obtain a meeting with the Buddha. May they avoid evil action and practice meritorious acts of good. Whatever evil, cruel act was done by me previously, I confess it all to the Buddhas. Whatever evil I've done, bad thought, bad word, by an act badly done, or not perceiving a mishap, whatever evil I've done by application of foolish reasoning, by a mind dark with ignorance, through the influence of anxiety or anger, through the fault of unsatisfied wealth, whatever evil I've done, by my association with ignoble people, by reason of envy, greed, or fault of guile, whatever evil I've done through failure to gain the mastery over my desires, by reason of fear at the time of approaching troubles, all this, I confess it all. So this is the weight of spiritual death, this kind of sense of really opening to the consequences of our actions. Fortunately, we then move through spiritual death to spiritual rebirth. So having really acknowledged where we find ourselves, we then have this kind of natural flow back out into connection with life. Once we've put down the shame, we've owned it, named it, we can then be free from that to actually re-engage with our values, with our deepest longings. This is the reason for confession. It's not to punish, it's to free us so that we can actually deepen our connection with the world, with life. And I've entitled this little bit, Finding the Thin Places. Don't know whether you've come across this term, thin places. So this is, I don't know where it comes from, to be honest, but certainly, so the idea is that it seems that, excuse me, my nose is hay fever through. Thin places. So it's this term describes natural places on the earth that seem to have a tangible energy or presence, that seem to be more than the surface knowing. It's this, everything in that place is filled with significance, has a particular quality to energy. It's as almost as if these places are speaking to us, trying to communicate with us. They seem to be wanting to show themselves in their fullness. Anybody know these places in your own life? A sense of what that is? It might not be a place, it might just be a group of trees. Or it might be a particular shape of a hillside. It seems to carry something more than its kind of mere, if you want, sort of description. Seems to be richer, fuller. So the more that we kind of attune ourselves to these thin places, we have the opportunity to really meet, begin to see the world as a living, breathing presence that wants to be known and seen, that wants to engage with us. So friendship is said to be the whole of the spiritual life. This is what the Buddha taught. So we actually begin to open to the world as an act of friendship, as kalyana. And kalyana, one of the ways of describing kalyana, this we have in this tradition, we talk about kalyana mitrata, spiritual friendship. So kalyana is actually points to the space that arises between you and me, you and the world, me and the world. It's not... Kalyana is not in me, it's not in you, it's in that space between us. It's something that arises through that space. And it's the same with the world. We're looking to the world to get a sense of this energy that arises
into those spaces between us, between the kind of the near, the moss, the tree, the river, whatever, and ourselves. There's something starts to come between. Another little poem from Basho. 3 months after we saw cherry blossoms together, I came to see the glorious twin trunks of the pine. So, the twin trunks of the pine. I just think that's such a... There's just something about these two pine trees standing there, and something is there, present between them. This is what I'm just trying to point to as a thin place. So we're looking to build, foster that connection with life. And also connection to trusting our own experience, our actual experience. Trust in our practice, trust in our small actions. So one of the problems with the ecological emergency is that we can feel that we have to do something that's kind of dramatic and huge that is going to change the world right now. But actually, what we really need to do is attend to our small actions. Each small action, just consider, take into account what we're doing. And, alongside that, recognise that we're not standing alone. We're not doing this by ourselves. It's not me that's going to have to save the world. It's we. And that we, the kind of collective nature of practice, even though we're all acting in our own small ways, it can be quite relieving to understand that it's not I, it's not me that has to save the planet. It's actually that engagement with life and training ourselves, supporting each other to really take our ethical practices seriously, to take our actions seriously, take our meditation seriously. That we lose this sense of isolation and overwhelm and become, well, reborn, spiritually reborn into Sangha. A Sangha that includes the world. So Sangha tends to be seen as individuals, as kind of human beings, but actually Sangha in its fullest sense is this world system, this planet, this biosphere, which includes us. So we're alive to what arises between each other, and we're alive to ourselves and the world. So last section, receptivity. So this really is the heart of all spiritual practice and certainly the heart of revisioning our connection to the world. So greed, hatred and delusion are manifestations of a belief in separate selfhood. This is the wheel of life, going back to the wheel of life. This is something that these forces bolster, defend, puff up, me, I, you. This is how it functions. So receptivity is working to actively counter that those forces. It counters by developing a sense of other power. So this is quite something that we say something about in Buddhism, and certainly the that sutra, that this sense of the drum, the golden, the beat of the drum, that is other power entering us. The sound of the drum is other power. So what we're trying to do through receptivity is just opening to the world as it is, so that the world, we can see it, that it's animated, that it's actually dancing before us, trying to engage us, trying to wave at us. It wants to be known. It wants to be interacted with in a healthy way. And one of the ways of looking at it or describing receptivity is actually, well, we're aware that it's that everything is without selfhood. That's basic Buddhist teaching. So there is that sense of emptiness, but it's empty. Because it is empty, it means it's got this infinite potential, this infinite arising of appearances. And that's what we can really enjoy, engage with, and draw on for our practice. So receptivity really creates the gap, which we've talked about endlessly. It creates the gap to let the world in, to let the world speak to us. It also encourages us to trust in the collective shared life. When we stop splitting self and other, self and world, then that really allows synchronicity and flow to begin to be able to come to function amongst us for our mutual benefit. So I'm just going to finish with a little quote from a book by David Abrahams, called The Sensuous, something about The Sensuous. Any approach to current problems that aims us towards a mentally envisaged future implicitly holds us within the oblivion of linear time. It holds us, that is, with the same illusory dimension that enabled us to neglect and finally to forget the land around us. By projecting the solution somewhere out of the perceivable present, it invites our attention away from sensuous surroundings. It induces us to dull our senses yet again on behalf of a mental ideal. A genuinely ecological approach does not work to attain a mentally envisioned future, but it strives to enter ever more deeply into the sensorial present. It strives to become ever more awake to the other lives, the other forms of sentience and sensibility that surrounds us in this open field of the present moment.